You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, special Ancient Asides edition. I think we're on like episode 10 of those or something like that. Today we will be talking about Constantine. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today is Jordan Poss. And Jordan, I always get the name of your school wrong, so I'm just going to let you do that this time.
Well, again, it changed in the last year, so I am at now at Piedmont Technical College, where I am an instructor of history.
Right. And we're recording this in the summer. Presumably by the time this drops, we'll be sort of mid-fall, late fall, something like that. What are you teaching there? Well, history, but specifically?
This summer I've got two sections of Western Civ 101, which is what we're covering, right?
Right.
So I've actually just covered Constantine a couple of weeks ago. I've got a section of African-American history, which is... obviously, our listeners can't see me, but I don't meet a few presumed qualifications to teach that. But it's a really great, really, really, really interesting subject matter. And again, it's kind of stretching me since I have no prior actual training in it beyond just, you know, general U.S. history.
Or experience as an African-American.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, that's a little bit different. I've actually been rebuilding that class from the ground up just over the course of the summer because I just became lead instructor on it after another instructor moved on from there. And I've also been designing a new humanities course for people who need a humanities credit but don't need it to transfer somewhere. And that's going to be in technology and culture, which is interesting because I tend to be a little bit reactionary about technology, despite, you know, using Skype right now and, you know, eventually going to listen to this again on my iPhone.
When I think a course on technology and culture, I will admit my first thought is some kind of science fiction based class. But I assume that's not what you mean.
Well, it's a humanities course. So right now, unless my department head tells me no, I'm planning to have the students read Frankenstein at least.
Okay, fair enough.
Any other suggestions would be welcome. this is not a topic I think about a ton outside at least of like a modern military history context with, you know, gunpowder and Minier balls and the Civil War and the atomic bomb and that kind of thing, but it's going to be a really, really interesting course, I think. And we'll offer it online, ptc.edu, if anybody's interested. I think they're going to try to get it into the catalog for the spring. So
I expect a check in the mail for that commercial advertisement. Well, we should move into our topic because Constantine. I mean, we could spend not just an entire episode of a podcast, but we could have an entire podcast just dedicated to Constantine. He is that important. In fact, I'm gonna make a statement, and I'd sort of like your response to it. And I intentionally didn't prep you for this beforehand. The more I learn about him, the more I'm coming to think that Constantine is the single most important individual in the ancient world outside of the Bible. Is that an overstatement? What do you think?
I don't know if it's an overstatement, but I don't disagree. He's one of those people who, you know, you don't have to believe in the great man theory of history to acknowledge his immense importance. I mean, even I'm not going to maybe jump in with both feet, but I would probably agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this, doing a little bit of prep for this. I mean, Augustine is certainly important, but there's no city of God without Constantine, right? Augustus is important, but he doesn't affect us the way that Constantine did. Especially as Christians, he doesn't affect us in that way. You know, Plato and Aristotle are both certainly important, but again, not in the same way and not with the same sort of impact. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and Constantine is positioned at one of those like pivot points of history that's going to give everything he does kind of outside, you know, excuse me, outsized ramifications. So, I mean, one of the people that pops to my mind who's more medieval than ancient would be, you know, Charlemagne. Right. But again, there is no Charlemagne without somebody like Constantine.
Right. Certainly true.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, if you listeners agree or disagree, yeah, you guys can. Listeners are free to drop us a note on Facebook or send an email and let us know if I'm wrong about that. So we left off with Diocletian. I don't remember exactly where we stopped with the Diocletian episode, but towards the end of his career, he had set up this tetrarchy with the two Augusti and the two Caesars as a way of dealing with succession and dividing up the empire so that there was political stability and competent administration. And we saw that it didn't work. Towards the end of Diocletian's life, people are starting to rebel against the system. Caesars are claiming to be Augusti, and people are just showing up and saying, hey, I'm an Augustus now too. I don't even remember from the last time we recorded one of these. I think Constantine might be the only one that gets acclaimed into the role. That is, the military sort of holds him up as an Augustus. I mean, maybe some of the others did. There's six of them, so it's certainly possible.
Yeah.
And through a series of diseases and small sort of small scale civil wars, these competitors are sort of knocked off one by one. So Galerius dies of a particularly nasty bowel cancer, which, you know, is not the way you want to go in any era, but especially before you have painkillers, that's not the way to go. A guy named Licinius moves east and sort of wipes out the other contenders in the eastern part of the empire. And Constantine, having been proclaimed emperor in York, modern-day York in England, takes the legions and moves onto the continent and begins marching closer and closer to Italy. And I'll turn the narrative over to you, Jordan, because this is sort of the first of many pivotal points in Constantine's career is this invasion of northern Italy.
Right. This is actually several years into his reign. Doing my kind of remedial background, brushing up to talk about this today, because you deal with it at such a high, superficial level in something like 101. The situation is so complicated. So Constantine is acclaimed emperor in York. At the same time, his great rival Maxentius is acclaimed emperor elsewhere. Constantine, though, is the one who gets official recognition, while Maxentius is regarded as something of a usurper or a pretender, but they kind of leave him alone for a while, and Constantine is up to other stuff.
Well, Maxentius is the son of the former emperor, right?
Right, yeah.
Who is still around and still also an Augustus.
Yeah, yeah. So, and there's also another wrinkle to it in that some of the people who recognize Constantine don't recognize him as an Augustus, but rather as simply a Caesar, right, which is another kind of weird, complexity to it. And we should go ahead and say as well that our sources for this period are better than they will be in a couple of hundred years, but they're not anything like, the era of Julius Caesar, for instance. What we would really like to have from this time period is a Tacitus or even a Plutarch to kind of like put some of this into coherent shape for us, because a lot of what we're going to talk about comes from contemporary sources who have wildly differing opinions of Constantine and his career. Some of them are blatantly partisan. We'll probably talk about all of that more later. So the big throwdown finally comes with Constantine advancing into northern Italy. Maxentius is holed up in Rome, and he's already actually resisted sieges within the walls of Rome itself a couple of times, which is what you would kind of expect him to do since Rome is large and heavily fortified. What he does instead, and at least one Constantine partisan is going to make this argument later, is that God hardening Pharaoh's heart through divine intervention, Maxentius makes the unwise decision to actually meet Constantine in open battle, with a pitched battle just north of the city of Rome on the banks of the Tiber. This area is now a suburb of Rome proper because the city has grown to encompass it. But this is at the Milvian Bridge, which is a bridge that spans the Tiber on the Via Flaminia, one of the northerly highways running from Rome up into the northern part of Italy. Maxentius, for whatever reason, and again, some of this is not super clear. Possibly he's partially destroyed the bridge, kind of like Horatius at this point, almost 1,000 years ago. Partially destroyed it to prepare for a siege, but there's some kind of wooden pontoon bridge as well that his troops are using to cross. He crosses the Tiber to Constantine's side and deploys with the river at his back, which is a mistake, a pretty elementary mistake, actually, and that's kind of led people to kind of question what's actually going on here, especially since, you know, spoiler alert, Maxentius is not going to be around much longer to explain himself. This is where it gets really, really interesting, and we'll have a whole lot more to say about this, because the battle itself, the battle that's about to unfold at the Milvian Bridge is important, but what apparently happens to Constantine is possibly even more important. So we've got three different versions of this from two authors. There's Lactantius and Eusebius. Both of them are Christians, so they have a kind of generically pro-Constantine attitude because of some later developments. Lactantius gives a shorter version of what happens to Constantine. He says that in a dream, he's told by some kind of angelic messenger to put a kind of generic symbol of Christ on his soldiers' shields prior to going into the battle, almost as kind of a talisman. And the symbol in this case is the Stourogram, which looks like a capital T with a, you know, P coming off the top of it. And it's a still relatively familiar symbol in church iconography today. The other versions come from Eusebius, who we'll probably talk about more later. He gives a kind of thumbnail sketch of the events in the Ecclesiastical History, but in another book, the actual dedicated life of Constantine, which is a pretty fawning biography, because Eusebius knows Constantine personally and claims to have gotten this story directly from Constantine. So if Eusebius here is trustworthy, and as biased as Eusebius is, I don't really see why we couldn't trust that this is, you know, probably more or less what happened.
Right. He probably didn't intentionally lie.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to put it. According to Constantine himself via Eusebius, what exactly happened was that as he was approaching Milvian Bridge, he looked up at the sun for some reason and saw
like Trump with the eclipse, right?
Yeah. 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 So he looked up at the sun and saw some sort of the description's kind of vague. It's not exactly clear what's going on. Some sort of cross shape near, above, or by the sun, apparently formed by the sun's rays. This has led some people to kind of, you know, euhemerize it as, rather than some sort of divine vision, it's like, you know, sun dogs or something like that. And those, honestly, those kinds of things sort of bore me. But anyway, this is what he claims to have seen, as well as a message translated into Latin. I can't remember the Greek, but translated into Latin, in hoc signo vincus, right? In this sign, conquer. And the sign in this case is, in Eusebius's version, is the chi rho, the what looks like an X and a P superimposed over each other as a ligature, which he has put on his standard, the labarum, and apparently has some of his soldiers paint on their shields prior to going into the battle. And we can talk more about this later. But they actually meet in battle October 28th, 312 AD, or AD 312. And Maxentius kind of mistakenly decides to meet Constantine in a couple of little bends of the Tiber River north of Rome. This allows both of them to kind of secure their flanks against the river. But Maxentius kind of gets himself boxed in with too little room for maneuver behind his lines. So when Constantine, who is a very skilled warrior, hits him with cavalry and then finally with, you know, a heavy infantry assault, Maxentius doesn't really have any place to go, right? No real good fallback position. So except for a good showing by the Praetorian guards, his army is basically routed. And if you're familiar with Civil War history at all, a route across a bridge never ends well. It's basically how First Manassas wrapped up. Right. Maxentius, at some point, there's a couple of sort of slightly varying accounts of his death. Some say that he was running so pell-mell to try to get ahead of his troops because he's such a coward that he fell off of the bridge and died. Others that he was kind of crowded off the bridge and drowned in the river, which to me anyway sounds more likely, although we'll never know exactly. And probably the difference in those accounts comes down more to propaganda value than factual goods. That's the ultimate. I mean, that's the story of the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, and probably the more important aspect. So, I'll turn it back over to you in a second, but I see two major results here. One, militarily and politically, is that Constantine has removed his only real rival in the West. He sends Maxentius's head to Carthage, which guarantees the loyalty of the province of Africa to him, which therefore quells any chance of rebellion, which basically solidly puts him in charge there. So that's the political outcome of this battle. The religious outcome we'll probably talk about a whole lot more, but whatever dream or vision he has in which he kind of strangely embraces Christian iconography, not necessarily Christianity, but rather symbols of Christianity, which I think is an important distinction. We're going to begin a long phase of first religious toleration and gradually dramatic religious change. Coyle, what would you add to or modify from that?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't add anything to the Milvian Bridge stuff. I think that's pretty solid. It's sort of frustrating because we have a lot of sources, right? Like you said, there's we're back into the really well documented stretch, but they are interested sources. They're sources that they're being written not necessarily out of a love of history, although I think obviously they have their preferences there too, but like you said, for propaganda purposes. We'll talk about Eusebius. I mean, Constantine is the beginning of the millennium, right? I mean, he is God's agent bringing God's kingdom to earth, and that is of necessity going to affect the way you color the facts.
Right.
We'll get more into the religious stuff in a minute because Constantine is just everywhere religiously. Politically, just a few things that come out of this. So Constantine secures the West. Licinius secures the East. Eventually, it comes to blows between the two of them, and Licinius is pretty handily defeated. I kind of wish I knew more about Constantine's military abilities. If he is a great general, I think he might be the last emperor who's a great general. Like there are some people coming down the pike who are genuinely gifted generals, Stilicho and Aetius and so on, but they're not emperors. And I think they're even, you know, occasionally barbarians who are brought into the empire. So I don't know. I don't know as much about that, and I kind of wish I knew more. The big point is the tetrarchy is over. The idea of four-man rule is basically dead. Constantine takes it back to one-man rule and really enforces that by eliminating absolutely everyone who even looks like they want to be emperor, including but not limited to his son, his wife, his father-in-law, two of his brothers-in-law. Constantine actually holds the record for the number of family members killed by a single emperor. There's that too when we're talking about whether or not he's a Christian. That's probably worth remembering.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't. It's sort of weird. He kills all of these people because he thinks they want to be emperor, but he still thinks that maybe one more than emperor is something that we should be thinking about. So he starts cutting up the empire even in his own life. Apparently planning to dole it out to his heirs. And at the very end of his life, he seems to have been planning a massive invasion of Persia, which suggests that he's going to be leaving someone else in charge while he's outside the empire. But he gets sick and dies before he can launch this invasion. And the empire goes to his children and his nephew, which we'll get to in a future episode. We won't bother with those guys today. So politically, we're back to one empire, one emperor, and he enforces that, although always with an eye to, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, maybe I should have some help. Further politically, even though the Tetrarchy fails, a lot of the administrative reforms that Diocletian had started, he carries on and really solidifies. So a lot of the offices that by the time we get to the Middle Ages will have become titles for nobility, those are really put down under Constantine. So Diocletian sort of kicks all of that off. Constantine's the guy who puts it in place, and this is all related to his economic reforms, which we'll also talk about, because this is all of these reforms are tied together. But the biggest thing, the biggest political thing that everyone who's had Western Civ knows about is the establishment of Constantinople. So he takes the old Greek city of Byzantium, renames it after himself, and declares it to be the new capital of the empire. Jordan, anything you want to say about Constantinople? I don't have a whole lot to say about it. He's smart in the way he does it, but
yeah, Constantinople is really. I mean, so my dad is a realtor, and then you know the three most important things about a piece of real estate are location, 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 right? Constantinople is just brilliantly situated. So I think that's. I mean, his selection of a site for the new capital, I think, is a large part of the reason that we're going to see the Eastern Empire last another 1,000 years.
Right.
Because it is got easy access to a lot of food coming from the Black Sea, the Ukraine, very easily fortified and defensible. So, I mean, there's a long stretch in the, you know, what we would call the High Middle Ages or the Renaissance era, in which the Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire, is just the city of Constantinople. And so, I mean, he's, you know, whatever gifts he does or does not have as a military leader, and they're apparently pretty considerable, but we don't really have the sources to, you know, give specifics on that. He at least has an eye for engineering and selecting a location. So, I mean, that's if he had not made any other decisions regarding the future of the empire than this one, it would probably be still one of the most important decisions that he makes, just strictly in terms of, I think, location. It's also situated in the richest half of the empire.
Right.
So, when I cover the rise of Christianity, for instance, in Western Civ, I show these maps of, you know, where we know there were early churches, and it's, you know, very urban. And of course, the cities of the East were wealthier by far than, you know, there are parts of Gaul that are only 3 or 4 generations removed at various points from Celtic barbarism, right?
Right.
So while we tend to associate the Roman Empire so closely with the West, and, you know, the fall of the empire is just, you know, when we say that, we're just talking about the fall in the West. He's resituated. He's shifting the center of gravity away from the West to, again, the richer, more populous, more Christian part of the empire, and the part that's actually going to last 1,000 years longer. As for the city itself, I mean, there's not a lot that I think we can say here that's not just sort of trivia, like, you know, the
right.
The chain across the Golden Horn and the you know, he's it's Justinian that builds the Hagia Sophia, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, even that is not, you know, we can't even really credit that to Constantine, but he does pick a splendid location.
Right. And it's not just splendid for being in a good place in that it's defensible itself. It's a good location to get to both the German frontier and the Persian frontier.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, it is, if you are an emperor and you need to be somewhere where something bad is going to happen, you're sort of equidistant between those two places.
Right. You can get to the mouth of the Danube in probably just a couple of days by ship.
Right. And he's smart in how he goes about this. So Constantine, he doesn't force anyone to move to his new capital. Instead, he rewards everyone who voluntarily moves there. So tax breaks, government jobs, and so on. He doesn't even really create a new government. He just rewards any senator who chooses to move to Constantinople. And of course, the Senate in Rome functionally doesn't matter much anyway. So why not move to Constantinople and get the government handout and so on. He also encourages cities across the empire to send ancient monuments and decorations and reward cities that do this. He doesn't punish anyone who doesn't, but cities that do this get rewarded. Gibbon hates this. He calls this the stripping of the empire. I think he might even call it the rape of the empire at one point.
Yeah, that sounds like Gibbon.
Yeah, because of course all of these, you know, ancient monuments are being shipped off to this, you know, the middle of nowhere from his perspective. And he engages in this aggressive building campaign. He hires the best architects and engineers from around the empire to build up his city. The centerpiece is the Hippodrome. Justinian builds the Hagia Sophia. He builds this 80,000-seat amphitheater, which I struggle to imagine that. I mean, there might be American buildings that'll hold 80,000 people, but I don't know that I could name one off the top of my head.
Well, some of the larger NFL stadiums will hold even more, won't they?
I don't know. That shows you how much I follow sports.
Yeah, well, same here. I can't even be sure off the top of my head. Let me see. NFL stadium capacity. No, 82,000 is what I'm seeing is kind of the upper limit of most of these.
All right, so we're sort of at Constantine's level.
Right. Yeah.
American civilization is almost almost to the third century AD, fourth century AD. Again, that's politically, which of course is I think is interesting, but is less interesting than some of the other stuff he did. Before we get to religious reforms, just briefly, his economic reforms. Yet, like Constantinople, if the only thing he had done was made his economic reforms, we still would remember Constantine. So things were bad coming out of the crisis of the third century, and then of course all of the civil wars following the collapse of the Tetrarchy. The economy of Rome is in shambles. Coins of the empire have been debased. At one point, I think they're making wooden coins. I mean, they're just things are not going well. There's been recovery. It's not quite crisis of the third century levels, but things are still bad. So Constantine puts in place a series of laws that freeze everything in place and put the economy of the empire on hold. That is, salaries don't go up or down, prices don't go up or down, jobs don't change. If you were a butcher last year, you're a butcher this year and the next year too, and you are guaranteed the income that you had last year. And people are ecstatic about these laws. We have, inscriptions of praise and gratitude from cities coming into Constantine about these. Because, it's sort of that promise that things aren't going to get worse. Mm-hmm. After years and years and years of financial decline, finally someone has stopped it. Obviously there's a trade-off is that it doesn't leave any room for improvement, right? Things aren't going to get worse, assuming these laws work, but they're not going to get better either. And these laws are hereditary. So if you were a butcher, well, now your kid's going to be a butcher too, which means if you're rich, your kid's going to be rich. And if you're poor, your kid's going to be poor, and going to stay poor. And there's no way out of that, which eventually will begin evolving towards feudalism. Right. I don't know that I would say this is a one-to-one court, like this is the beginning of feudalism exactly, but there's definitely a connection there.
Mm-hmm.
In class, I always make the students sort of kick around, are these laws good or bad? If you knew that next year would not be any worse than last year, would you be happy? Right? Would that be satisfying? And very mixed thoughts on it, especially in our economy today, right?
Oh yeah.
So again, these laws that in directly or indirectly, lead to 1,000 years of social stability, that has some value too. As part of his attempt to reform the currency, Constantine introduces a new kind of coin. This is the solidus. I'm not sure how you say that. This is a solid gold coin, hence the name. They contained about 4.5 grams of gold. It was worth 275,000 of the currency that were circulating at the time. So the denarii, the sort of traditional Roman coins, had just completely fallen off in terms of their value. Constantine does his job well. This coin actually doesn't devalue for 600 years. Mm-hmm. So its value stays the same or goes up for six centuries. And it's the standard currency in Europe and the Mediterranean for almost a millennium, until it's finally replaced by the florin in the 1300s. So the empire has more problems, but for the rest of the Western Empire, the problems aren't financial. And it takes 600 years before the Eastern Empire has true economic challenges. Jordan, anything on economics or politics? Otherwise, we'll get to the good stuff.
Yeah, I can't add anything of supreme substance to any of that. One other thing I'll say about Constantinople, though, is this is the only time you'll hear me claim the title Child of the 90s. Hmm. But Tiny Toons, had that They Will Be Giants song. Istanbul was Constantinople.
Yeah.
If you haven't heard that, go look it up and get it in your head for the rest of the year. It's a lot of fun.
I'll try to remember to link that in the show notes.
Yeah, maybe play it over the closing credits.
I feel like that was a song before Tiny Toons, though.
Oh yeah, I mean it is a pre-existing song by They Might Be Giants. My first exposure was just this weird, Indiana Jones Casablanca inspired music video Tiny Toons did with it.
Right.
Go figure.
So Constantine and the Christians. Constantine has this vision at the Milvian Bridge. And shortly thereafter, and I should have written down the date of this, he and Licinius, who at the time is still a co-emperor, they issue the Edict of Milan. So the Edict of Milan does four things. It ends persecution, including inside the government and the military. So if you're a Christian, you can now be a government official. You can now serve in the military. You no longer have to make those sacrifices to the pagan gods. It allows freedom of conscience in worship. So you can go to the pagan temple, you can go to the Christian church, you can go wherever you want to go. That's now allowed. It returns or makes restitution for seized land and buildings, which will actually be the first sort of religious crisis that Constantine has to deal with. And then it allows the church to own property, which isn't to say there weren't churches or church buildings before this, but now they are legal, right? They're mm-hmm. not owned in the name of a member or something like that. Now this edict is for all religions. It's not just Christianity. Under this edict, toleration becomes sort of the formal rule of the day, which is interesting because up until this point, Rome has been explicitly pagan. Yeah. And so being a Roman citizen means that you are supposed to do certain things like worship the gods, including the emperor. Even more true if you're a government official, where you would have to make public sacrifices to the gods. And now nobody has to do that who doesn't want to. Our religion is sort of momentarily cut out of the state. Now, this doesn't last, but at the moment at least, church and state are somewhat separate, or at least slightly distanced from each other.
Well, we're seeing the introduction of a vague hint that there will be a split between those two things, because Constantine, even though he clearly favors Christianity, he continues to make sacrifices himself as emperor. He'll go to church and make sacrifices, apparently, and we'll talk about this more, but I mean, everything Constantine does is a subject of controversy and multiple interpretations, but the most reasonable interpretation I've seen of that is that he's simply trying to split the difference and kind of occupy some sort of middle position between the two kind of spiritual halves of his empire.
Right.
And even that you can interpret either totally cynically or through some kind of, you know, some sort of sincere concern for actual toleration, but you know, it's open to interpretation.
Yeah. And obviously one of the problems is that's a difference that can't be split. So up until, and potentially even including Constantine, but at least up until Constantine, the emperor was a god, or even if you didn't think, you know, a specific emperor was a god, the office is divine. That was sort of Diocletian's big claim is, yeah, I'm not a god, but the office of emperor is divinity. It involves mm-hmm. divinity or what have you. Well, once you say Christians don't have to worship the emperor, you've functionally said the emperor's not a god.
Right.
You can't say here's a god, but don't bother worshiping him.
Right. Still accepts worship, which is
right.
Again, you know, what exactly do you do with this? This is a really weird pivot point because it doesn't exactly fit either what's coming or what we've seen before.
Right. Yeah, and it's well, and even the fact of, you know, whether Constantine truly converted or not, you know, that's an unanswerable question, I think.
Yeah.
Whether he truly converted or not, once he is associated with Christians, he is at most a pagan convert, mm-hmm. which means that he is not the head of the church, which means that you now have the emperor as just another member of an organization with an authority figure over him.
Right.
Or at least that's, you know, one line of argument. So with the pagans, you don't have to worry about that. You know, the emperor is the Pontifex Maximus, mm-hmm. Whether you like it or not. The emperor certainly is not the bishop. So we have our first serious limitation put in place on the emperor in the history of the Roman Empire. He does not get to command the church.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's not the end of the matter. This gets discussed for a millennium, right?
Yeah.
Until there isn't any emperor anymore. But clearly, the critical moment in the political history of Rome. Now you have an area that's carved out where the emperor no longer has direct power or direct say.
Right. Right.
Anything to add on the Edict of Milan specifically before we get into the broader issues?
No, just to point out explicitly, you know, I think more highly of our listeners than this, but I do have students who get confused on this point. For whatever reason, there's a, you know, and I'll just go ahead and dump on Dan Brown again, but there's some kind of misapprehension out there that Constantine doesn't just legalize Christianity and issue an edict of toleration, but actually makes Christianity the official cult of the state. And that's not the case. That's still coming actually a pretty good ways down the road. One of the things that makes Constantine so difficult to understand is the fact that he's kind of participating in the two rival camps at the same time,
right,
for whatever reason, for whatever purpose, and whatever end he has in mind. So what we are talking about is strictly religious toleration, which is a new thing, you know, totally. But not actually, you know, straight up making Christianity the official religion of the state, which I think is an important distinction.
Yeah, and that's so Constantine, like Diocletian, like every good emperor before him, was trying to restore Rome. Right, he's a conservative trying to bring back the good old days. So you know, what is he doing tolerating Christianity, which is about as anti-traditional Roman as you can get?
Right.
Basically, I think this is sort of the general scholarly consensus, is that he's trying to tap into the youth and energy of Christianity as this new moving force in the empire. So the imperial bureaucracy, especially the pagan aspects of it, has gotten old and tired and bloated, as tends to happen to us as we age. While Christianity is this fresh and young and new thing, and can't we sort of tap into that energy and leech it for the good of the empire?
Yeah.
If you want to say it another way, Constantine is trying to use the church to buttress a collapsing empire. Think of the way the Republicans used evangelicals in the 1980s, or the way, you know, Bernie Sanders used ignorant millennials in the 2016 election. Constantine is trying to tap into that sort of divine power and put it to work for the state. That's old news. What's new is that he's trying to do it with Christianity instead of the traditional Roman gods.
Right. And there's another, you know, a related argument that I've seen is also a kind of demographic argument, which is, you know, essentially that Constantine kind of sees which way the tide is flowing and decides to get on the side that is in the ascendant. So we don't have solid numbers, but if the empire isn't split 50-50 by this point, Christians are probably a very large minority, a really unmistakable, unignorable, to coin a barbarism, component of the empire that he just can't afford to alienate at this stage of the game. That's a slightly more and of course even there you can take it in sincere versus cynical directions. But I've seen that bandied around as well, and probably, you know, we can come up with 10 different explanations with multiple sets of interpretations of each of those, and probably there's at least a component of truth to most of them.
Yeah, and I will say that most of these make me a little bit uncomfortable just because none of our sources say that.
Yeah. Right?
All of them say he was a Christian.
Right.
So Eusebius and Lactantius and then of course the later sources, they all, Constantine converted to Christianity and that's why he was doing all of this.
Right.
And it rubs me the wrong way to go against our sources.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's so much that's just at this stage of the game, this, you know, 1700 years later, that, you know, is simply trying to kind of read between the lines and sort of ignore what the sources are saying in favor of what might be there. And I think the reason we do have to fall back on that, at least some, I mean, regardless of what your view of Constantine is simply the fact that Constantine was kind of cagey. And his own behavior doesn't always stack up with what the sources say about him.
Right. Yeah, he if the sources are right that he's a Christian, then he ought to have been excommunicated multiple times.
Immediately, yeah.
Right.
For Arianism, for murder, for whatever.
Right. Yeah. And ultimately, I mean, even if we go the sort of Machiavellian, you know, he is doing this for political purposes route, it doesn't work.
Right.
I mean, so, and maybe that's an argument in favor of, you know, maybe he really did believe some of this because he keeps failing at trying to get these Christians to do the political things he wants them to do.
Yes.
Largely because... Well, for a number of reasons, one of which being Constantine never becomes a Christian Pontifex Maximus. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we can say he really tries, but I suspect he would have taken it if it had been offered to him. Instead, what he does is he forces Christians to argue about and sort of continually rethink the social and political implications of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So prior to Constantine, Christian political thought was basically, how do we endure under persecution How do we deal with conversion if you're a soldier or government official when you convert? And what do you do when the persecution's over with the people who left the faith and now want back? Those are sort of the core political issues.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, persecution's no longer the sort of defining relationship between the church and the state. That opens up this wide range of other options. You know, what are we supposed to do? You know, is there such a thing as a Christian state? Well, no one had ever thought about that before, right? If so, what does it look like? What does it mean if the emperor and the government now say, hey, we're all Christians? What does that mean practically? This, by the way, this is when monasticism really takes off.
Mm-hmm.
It's not under persecution. It's under toleration.
Yeah.
That the monks say, wait a second, this is this government stuff is not Christianity. Christians are called to live apart from the world. We're to be in parts of a community that is not a part of the state. So the monasteries now start to grow.
And to, you know, not to get too current with this, but to the credit of some of our kind of Christian cultural commentators, you know, you've got your, as hysterical as he can sometimes be, you've got your Rod Dreher's, right, who are, you know, not being triumphalist about the apparent evangelical victory in the 2016 election, but are rather counseling caution. And I don't like the word retreat, but, you know, that Benedict option or whatever. I'm reading a book by Anthony Esselin right now, who's my favorite Dante translator, who is, you know, making some kind of Dreher-esque arguments, but I think actually a little bit better, encouraging us not to rest on our laurels and see the corruption that's actually around us and warn us off from participating in it simply because we actually have political power at the time,
right?
Which I think is always smart to keep in mind. Because as you were pointing out, there's a lot in the scripture about what to do about persecution and, not renouncing the name of Christ, that kind of thing when you are actually being persecuted. There's not a ton in there about, you know, triumphantly wielding the sword of the persecutor once you come to power.
Right, we should pray for the king. It doesn't tell us what to do if we are the king.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was trying to say, yeah.
Yeah, and again, I mean, there's not an answer. There's no solid answer that we can give. I generally say, you know, go read Augustine's City of God, and that's the best answer we've got.
Yeah.
But of course, people would disagree with that too.
well, I'll agree with you.
They're wrong. so yeah, this attempt to sort of leech off Christianity fails, because Christians don't really have a category at this point for thinking about responsible governance as Christians. And then, of course, there's the fact that Christians don't get along with each other. There are different sects, and there are schisms, and there are heretics, and so on. So Constantine's first major encounter with Christians and their infighting comes with the Donatists. I don't remember. Did we talk about the Donatists? I think we did in the Diocletian episode.
I think we pointed toward them. But we might have described what they are, but might have punted fuller discussion until later.
Yeah. So the Donatists were the descendants of the people during the persecution under Diocletian who had not turned in scriptures. So the initial persecution under Diocletian is turn over your Bibles and we're going to destroy your Bibles and your religion of the book. So that'll be the end of your religion. Some pastors, some bishops did turn over these books. After the persecution is over, again, the question is, well, what do you do with these bishops? All right, so the Donatists say that if you were a traditor, that is a hander over of the Bible, you have lost your right to be a bishop. Maybe you can still be a Christian. Maybe you can still come to church. You don't get to be a bishop anymore. Only the people who were either actively persecuted, you know, sat in jail, or were tortured or whatever, or who ran away and hid or refused to turn in their books, they're the legitimate bishops. And then, of course, that generation dies off, and now you have, well, the next generation. What if it's someone who is ordained as a bishop? They're still congregationally elected at this point, but the previous bishop also has to sort of give the vote of approval. Well, what if your approval came from someone who is a traditor? Well, again, the Donatists are saying, no, that's not legitimate. That guy's not a real bishop. Only if you were ordained by someone who did not give into persecution. And then farther and farther down the road, by the time we get to Augustine, you know, it's a century later, you have these two churches that have developed sort of side by side. In the modern world, we don't blink an eye about that, right? Post-Protestant Reformation, we're like, yeah, so a bunch of denominations, who cares? Back then, there's very much the idea that you might have different churches in different cities, but they should all be in communion with each other.
Right.
This idea of splitting off is not okay.
Is Christ divided, right?
Right. So when the Edict of Milan comes out and says restitution for buildings that have been taken away, the question in North Africa is who gets the restitution? Does it go to the Catholics, small c Catholics, or does it go to the Donatists? The Donatists appeal to Constantine. Constantine defers them to a court of bishops drawn from France, and I think the Bishop of Rome is in on that. I don't remember off the top of my head. Of course, there are no Donatists in France or in Italy, so they decide against the Donatists in favor of the Catholics. The Donatists then appeal to the emperor. Constantine hears their case and decides against them. And the Donatists then reply with, well, you don't get a say because church and state shouldn't be combined anyway. Having appealed to the emperor, they then say the emperor has no right to make that decision when they don't like it. The point is Constantine is starting to get a huge headache, which is, you know, a sign that worse is coming, which leads us into to Arianism. Jordan, anything to add on the Donatists?
Not off the top of my head. I think we, between what you've said and what I think we said about in the Diocletian episode, I think we've got it covered. And this problem is not going to go away immediately. I think Augustine is still dealing with the Donatists later, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. The problem goes away when the Vandals come in and kill everyone. I mean,
right.
and then the Muslims a couple of centuries later.
Right.
So it does go away, but not for, you know, several centuries after this.
Right.
You basically have these two churches kind of squabbling side by side until there are no more Christians left.
Right.
The bigger issue, and the one that's going to be much more familiar, is the Arian heresy. There's a Christian humanist episode on Arianism, and specifically on Nicholas of Myra at Nicaea.
Mm-hmm.
So I will direct our listeners to go and listen to that to get some of the nuts and bolts. Bigger picture thing, in Alexandria, there's a bishop named Alexander who begins his lectures with the statement, always God, always the Son. So every lecture he begins, it's sort of a Cato the Elder type thing, you know, Carthage must be destroyed, except in this case, always God, always the Son, by which he meant God the Father and Jesus the Son were different persons, but of the same substance. One of the local presbyters, a guy named Arius, said, well, wait a second, that doesn't make sense. If you've got the Father and the Son, and you say they're both God, then you've got two gods, and that's dualism at best, maybe just polytheism. Instead, we have to say that God made Jesus. He made him first, he made him best, and Jesus in turn made everything else, became a man, died for our sins, all that's fine. But there was a time when he was not, and that becomes the great Arian rallying cry. There was a time when he was not. What especially made this challenging was that both Arius and Alexander were not great theologians, but they were great sort of jingle writers.
Yeah.
So they would write commercials in the modern world if they were alive today.
Ancient theological Don Drapers.
Yeah, pretty much. So Arius turns his theological ideas into popular drinking songs. One of them that's lasted. If you want the Logos doctrine, I can serve it steaming hot. God begat him, and before he was begotten, he was not. Everyone gets in on this debate. So one church father writes, you can't even go to the grocery store anymore. You know, if you ask for a loaf of bread, the baker will reply, the Son is subordinate to the Father. If you give your employees a job to do, they'll say the Son arose out of nothing. In Alexandria, riots break out between the Arians and the Orthodox, which is where Constantine steps in. Of course, once you have citizens rioting against each other, the emperor is going to get involved.
Right.
Constantine, and Dan Brown gets at least this one point right, Constantine calls the First Ecumenical Council of Nicaea. He didn't know it was the First Ecumenical Council of Nicaea, but he calls in 325. So the head of state does, in fact, involve himself in church affairs. He does attend the council, but he seems not to say anything if he's there. With with the potential exception of throwing Nicholas of Myra in jail for punching Arius, which I'm sorry, listeners, that probably didn't happen. Our source for that is late medieval, like late medieval, so sort of thousands, 1100, something like that. But it is a good story. So again, go listen to the Christian Humanist.
Still a better Santa Claus than what we've got now.
Oh yeah. Jordan, anything you want to say about the Council of Nicaea? I don't really want to dig into the weeds of it, but
not tremendously. This right here, though, you mentioned Dan Brown, and I mean, I already opened that can of worms earlier. This is where, you know, Constantine's conversion usually isn't what bugs people; it's his involvement in things like the Council of Nicaea.
Right.
And again, as you say, he appears to have attended but not actually actively participated, kind of leaving the bishops to do their thing. Depending on who you read, he seems actually to have favored the Arian side,
right,
which makes sense to me because Constantine seems to be a theological noob. He's a soldier. He's a politician. He's an engineer. The finer points of theology don't. It is not clear how well he actually grasps, like, the doctrine of Christianity.
Right.
So it's less a story, it seems, of him trying to impose his favored interpretation on a whole bunch of bishops, which is the Dan Brown version of the story, and more that he is simply trying to use the power of his... I hesitate to use the word state, but we'll just run with it. Try to use the power of the state to enforce some kind of theological uniformity, regardless of what they decide that is. And because he's kind of theologically unversed, the simplicity of the Arian message seems to appeal to him.
Right.
But when they decide against it, overwhelmingly, he abides by their ruling, which, again, kind of suborns the image, you know, of the kind of nefarious emperor sort of swooping in and wreaking his will on supine church that can't possibly resist his power. And you know, you're getting this image from everywhere, from Dan Brown on one end of the spectrum to Jack Chick on another, right? We talked,
right.
I think in one of Chick's tracks he even says Constantine was the first pope, letting his which is the weirdest iteration of anti-Catholicism, one of the weirdest ones I've run across. So regardless of what you actually think about the marriage of his piety to his power, he's at least letting the church still run some of its own affairs, which, regardless of what else you think about him and what he's done, speaks well for him, at least in terms of him submitting to the authority of his religious elders. I don't know. I think that's about all I've got to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously the council releases the, you know, the Nicene Creed, which notes that Jesus is of the same substance as the Father and begotten but not created. The council neither solves the problem of Arianism, nor solves the problem of church-state relations. Right.
Right.
If anything, all it does is undermines the role of the emperor,
right,
and reinforces the idea that that the structure of the church, especially when it's gathered together in the shape of a council, is the true source of power in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Constantine who calls the council, like you said, he submits to its decision, and then even to some extent enforces it. Well, that sends the signal that, well, where's the real power at? Well, it's in this gathering of bishops.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who's there, who really sort of absorbs all of these lessons, is Athanasius. So Athanasius, this is a Constantine episode, not an Athanasius episode, but basically comes away from Nicaea that the way to solve problems in the church is, first of all, appeal to Scripture. He's big on that. Second, try to solve it in your local congregation. And if that fails, then you call this all-church council, you know, the big gathering of bishops. Well, he was a presbyter, so I suppose bishops and presbyters. What you shouldn't do, according to Athanasius, is involve the emperor in theology. And he's so insistent about this that he actually gets himself exiled by Constantine. and then by four more times afterwards, he ends up being exiled five times total. So Athanasius contra mundum is the big saying.
Yeah.
So Constantine just he tries to solve this religious problem in Christianity. Christians aren't having any of it. All he does is undermine his own authority, and honestly probably accelerate the final collapse of the empire, because now Christians are fighting each other and ignoring what the emperor says religiously, even when later emperors try to take a more active role in the theology of the church. It leads to a lot of bloodshed, but it never functionally works. Man, there's so much more we could say about Constantine. Anything else about Nicaea?
No, I think that's pretty well got it.
So what does this matter for us today? All of this this Constantine religious stuff. Why? And I see not to jump ahead. I see under the recommended readings you've got Peter Leithart's book.
Yeah.
why should we care about Constantine as Christians? And as people who care about, you know, ideas and politics and theology and so on in the 21st century?
I'll go ahead. I've been thinking about this all day when I, you know, have been in the middle of advising students for the fall.
Much more interesting than talking to students.
Yeah. Well, about their high school transcripts and stuff, definitely.
Right.
I'll get to Peter Leithart. I'm going to recommend it, but I want to recommend it with some caveats. As I've been thinking about this, I've been trying to think about exactly what about Constantine's story is most relevant for us. And a couple of years ago, I probably would have been able to give a really solid, firm answer. But now, mostly what I see is the newness of his situation. And I think you can chalk at least some of the negative consequences of his actions up to the fact that he was making it up as he went along. I mean, he was the first guy to do some of these things, right? He is the first person to confront this problem. And so you can only fault him so much for making the wrong choice. He's the first guy walking into this minefield.
right.
If he steps on a mine, you know, it's going to be inevitable to some extent. Constantine usually gets invoked as some sort of like warning against, you know, Caesaropapism, the absolute marriage of religious and state power. Despite some of the more fervid fever dreams of political partisans, that's not really something we've had to seriously contend with in the United States. There has been political power used to religious ends with things like the Blaine Amendments and stuff like that, but never to the extent of, you know, President Trump, you know, convening a council of all, you know. President Trump is not actually getting he is not the one who got the Southern Baptists to all get together and issue the Nashville Statement or whatever. You know, we're not having issues like that.
Oh my gosh, he would get so bored so fast.
I can only
imagine. Something
like
that.
Like I would actually kind of love to see that.
I mean, like if I wanted to punish him with something short of impeachment, I would make him go to a meeting like that and not let him have his phone.
Oh, that would be fantastic. Except we'd miss out on all those amazing theologically illiterate live tweets. So mostly what I see now is like the newness of his situation to him and to the empire, but also just the foreignness of it because the form of political power that he had was, again, I think it's Nathan Gilmore on the Flagship podcast says he kind of like pokes at his students by telling them, you know, in the ancient world there was no such thing as religion, you know, because these things were not like neatly compartmentalized the way they are in sort of a post-Enlightenment world. And that's actually one of the points that Leithart is going to make in the book I'm going to recommend by him. So, I mean, the world we're looking at has these struggles of state and church, you know, to use our terms for it. But they're not the same struggles, at least not that I can see. So the principles I think we can extract are going to be very, very general. I think, you know, a really important one that maybe, you know, like just occurred to me as you were kind of describing Christian resistance to some of Constantine's interference is that possibly Christians in the United States have gotten a little bit too, I don't want to say drunk. We are perhaps too attached to the democratic ideal in that the idea that we have a say, you know, And we'll do whatever it takes to preserve that say, because, again, to go back to Scripture, there's a whole lot about enduring persecution. There's not a whole lot about, you know, choosing the right candidate in elections, because that's not really an option that was open to Christians at the time. So when you get an election like the one 2 years ago, the concern to have our guy in power, I think, is something that we really need to watch out for, because ultimately our guy is still going to be functionally the leader of a city of man, right? A city that's going to be perishable, and that's going to have completely perishable ends as its mission and its purpose. Beyond that kind of general warning to avoid getting, I mean, essentially I'm falling back on the truism, don't get too hung up in politics, right? This is the fortune cookie advice that I've worked myself toward.
Which wasn't an option before Constantine.
Right. Yeah. So, exactly. I started off by talking about what a pivot point that he stands at. That's what we have pivoted toward is that kind of dichotomy. I don't know. What do you think the relevance is? Maybe I'll have something intelligent to say in response or by pushing back.
No, I think I largely agree with that. I think Constantine is useful as a sort of measure of where sort of our own political ideas fall. So, mm-hmm. how someone responds to Constantine probably tells us more about that person than about, you know, any historical reality of what Constantine did or didn't do. And I think I have very mixed thoughts about him. So in a second, I'm going to ask, is he a good guy or a bad guy? And I'll tip my hand. I think he was probably a bad guy, but he did such good things that I'm willing to sort of waffle on that answer. And I'm sort of willing to waffle on this answer I think toleration is a great thing. I think that stopping persecution is a great thing.
Yeah.
I think the beginning of a marriage between church and state that would not come to an end, at least so far, is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you have sort of moments of separation of church and state, but those moments where it happens in history are almost always, I'm trying to think of a generous way to say this, or even a short way to say this, there are almost always moments when the person calling for separation has lost some kind of major argument.
Yeah.
So I was talking about this on another podcast recently, which hopefully will have dropped by the time this drops. I really enjoy and appreciate the Puritans. Their political philosophy was terrible.
Yes.
It was a totally and wildly inappropriate blending of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, I suspect I only think that because, as a Baptist, the people that I agree with at the time most theologically were some of the most persecuted.
Right.
So I think that tends to be the case sort of all along the way, right? That the Christians who are calling for what I would see as a more proper separation, it's always more proper separation because there's something they don't want to do that they're going to have to do otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not accept that with most political arguments, so I'm a little hesitant about accepting it here.
Yeah.
So the fact that you've lost a debate doesn't mean that you get to take your toys and go home necessarily.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say I think we should go and, you know, have to make sacrifices to Jupiter or whatever. Again, I think toleration is a good thing, and, mm-hmm. and I, again, he's a bad guy who did some really good stuff. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you think? I'm rambling, Jordan. Is he a good guy or a bad guy?
Yeah, I was getting into the rambling mode there, too. So, good guy or bad guy, I'm going to say yes. I think I pretty much agree with you. I will probably lean a little bit more into the good guy territory, but not for any reason I can really put my finger on at the moment, primarily just for the long-term benefit of ending religious persecution. I'll also say that despite, you know, again, political murders and intrigues and, you know, some brutal military campaigns and some unwanted interference, he at least still backed down what was important that he did. He did not, in fact, enforce his personal theological opinions on the church. He did, to a debatable extent, help kind of get the Arian thing out and in the fresh air, so where people could actually like talk about it and get it resolved, in a council, which still took a very long time to work out. I think those more or less counterbalance his political evils. But again, I'd be willing to waffle on that as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I know that when I've talked about this with other people, there are always folks who want to bring up, Arianism is still with us, with yeah. Mormonism and so on. And that's right. Sort of true. There's not a line from Arius right. to Joseph Smith. That's not that's not completely accurate. But he's a complicated guy.
Yeah, and it's hard to make up my mind on him because I want to keep pushing back against that church state dichotomy, which doesn't exactly exist at this time because of the political realities and religious realities we've been talking to up to this point. But his life, again, because it's at this pivot point, it makes a church state divide intelligible, even if it's not something we can neatly map onto his life, which is, again, just muddying the waters. And then there's his own caginess about what his motivation is, and it's in a way it's weirdly easier to talk about things in the purely pagan era of, Cicero and Caesar, because at least all of those guys have, are operating within the same categories of thought, even if they're very alien to us. The fact that some of Constantine's issues are getting a little bit more familiar looking actually makes it more confusing, I think.
Well, and we don't have the same kind of investment in a Cicero-Caesar argument, right? Yes, I prefer Cicero to Caesar.
Yes.
But I mean, at the end of the day, they're squabbling over the future of the Roman Republic, and I'm not a Roman. I am a Christian, right?
Yeah.
And that's there is a continuity there.
And Richard Dawkins never brings up Cicero, so
that's true.
Right.
Maybe he should. He might be happier if he did. Actually, I think I meant to point this out last episode, and I just forgot. I believe with the rise of Diocletian. And Constantine is probably a sign of this. We're done with the crazy emperors, right? There are no more Commoduses or Caligulas or anyone like that. I mean, there are certainly evil emperors.
Right.
There's one who takes an axe and chops apart a general on the floor of the imperial courtroom. But he also thought the general was conspiring against him.
Right.
But we're done with people, nominating their horses as senators and so on.
Right.
Which I think is there's probably a study to be written of that. I don't know enough about the empire to know. Is it just now that the only way to get power is to be named by another emperor or by the army? So if you're insane, there's no real way of getting yourself in. I don't know. I don't know what the reason is.
In a way, it's almost become more meritocratic. So only if you've already proved yourself as a general and your troops trust you enough to acclaim you, can you actually get to that position. So that may at least explain some of the winnowing of the nuts.
Right. And to some extent, the empire is in not at this point and not under Constantine, but starting within about 50 years of his death, the empire is in such constant crisis, right, that having a crazy emperor really isn't an option.
Right.
So Constantine dies, the empire is still fine. It's largely recovered from the crisis of the third century. We're going to start seeing barbarian movements in the next few decades, and that will create yet another crisis, and how to deal with that becomes sort of the major issue of the end of the empire, with various emperors trying various things and none of them really working.
But, yeah.
How to deal with lots and lots of people that you sort of want in your country and sort of don't want there. So the application for us will be maybe clearer when we get there.
Yeah.
If we want to know more about this, Jordan, what should we read?
I just put together a little short reading recommendation. Some of these we've already talked about. Goldsworthy's book, How Rome Fell. We've talked about before. He's got a pretty good coverage of Constantine. Michael Grant is a historian that we've come back to several times. He's got a book called Constantine the Great, which is perhaps a little dated. I believe it was published in the 70s or the 80s. I've got a Barnes & Noble reprint of the book. It's, same text, just, Barnes & Noble got their paws on it somehow and put their logo on the spine. Sure. Constantine the Great, pretty good, solid biography. If you're familiar with military history and you like military history books, there's a series called Osprey, It's a British publisher that does these really wonderfully and lavishly illustrated campaign guides and books just about, you know, particular battles, equipment, stuff like that, usually to a very, very high standard. And they have a book on the Battle of Milvian Bridge called Milvian Bridge AD 312 by an author named Ross Cowan. The one fiction one book, since we've recommended some fiction before, I mentioned it before, but Helena by Evelyn Waugh, a very short novel by a master of English prose. Don't go to it for really like authentic historical knowledge. Waugh follows a late tradition, which is unfounded, that Constantine's mother was the daughter of King Cole, or King Coyle, actually, in Welsh. That tradition has no basis in historical fact, but he builds a very interesting fictional narrative around the life of Helen as she is raised, marries Constantius Chlorus. Constantine's father is divorced and then eventually widowed, and becomes the mother to this very, very powerful man who embraces a new religion, and then they begin dealing with, you know, all the kinds of heresies that are out there. Again, not necessarily historically accurate, but a very good kind of historical imagining of this period. And the book we referred to a couple of times already is Peter Lightheart, who what denomination exactly does he belong to? Just like the Reformed Church?
It's a made up one. Okay, yeah. So it's I have a Profiles interview with him.
Yeah.
And I will say I've been largely irritated by anything I've ever read by Lightheart. And I'll throw up a link both to, I mean, the interview is not really related to any of this, mm-hmm. But he's in this denomination that it's like some kind of amalgam of Presbyterian and Baptist.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's got the word Reformed in the name, but he's always been a little bit of a mystery to me. And he's out there in Moscow, Idaho with Doug Wilson.
No. He's in your part of the country now.
Oh, really? Okay.
Is he in Georgia or North Carolina? He's somewhere over in there.
I did not know this. I'm primarily familiar with Lightheart because he writes and blogs at First Things pretty frequently. I like what he's got to say probably 60% of the time. Some of it's just navel gazing, but it's usually interesting navel gazing. Anyway, he's got a book called Defending Constantine, which I recommend. I don't agree with everything in it, but it's a pretty bracing polemic. Basically offering up pro-Constantine arguments from a theologically Protestant Reformed perspective, particularly targeting John Howard. Is it John Howard Yoder?
The Anabaptist.
Right? Yeah, and I believe Lightheart even crosses swords with Gilmore's homeboy, Stanley Hauerwas. I think he brings both of those in. It's been a couple of years since I've read it. But he's engaging not just the kind of Dan Brown anti-Constantine perspective, but also some perspectives that are primarily political in orientation, and in his argument are only viable if you import modern religious and political philosophical categories into a world in which that doesn't actually make any sense. It's a really good book. I recommend it, and offers, again, a kind of rare, largely positive but not worshipful perspective on Constantine and his career, and especially his the religious component of his reign.
Right.
Yeah. What have you got?
Yeah, and I'll say I have not read this book of his, so I shouldn't trash Lightheart for a book that I have not read. Trash him for the books that I have read.
I appreciated this one. I think it's the only one by him I've actually read. I I've read a bunch of his blog posts, but otherwise, this is my only book length experience of him, and I appreciated it.
So I'll recommend, of course, the two primary sources that you mentioned, Lactantius and Eusebius. Eusebius, his life of Constantine, it's kind of a slog. The praise starts to pile up to the point where you're like, good Lord, man, just get on with the life. Much more important and much more readable, his History of the Church is the place to go. Mm-hmm. Lactantius, I forget what specifically his writings about Constantine were, but was he Constantine's tutor or the tutor of Constantine's kids? I forget exactly. There's some kind of personal relationship.
Yeah, there's some kind of connection, but I can't remember what it is off the top of my head.
I mean, all of these aristocrats knew each other, so yeah. There's probably a communist conspiracy history of the Roman Empire to be written.
I'm sure it's already been written.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, maybe by Marx. Who knows?
Yeah.
In terms of secondary sources, we mentioned it several times, Christianity and Classical Culture,
yes.
By Charles Norris Cochran. Fantastic book, totally. Totally worth reading. The section on Constantine is extensive and worth attention. And then my sort of go-to biography is a very negative biography, but it's I think all the facts are right. Constantine and the Conversion of Europe. I believe the author's name is Jones, who is critical of Constantine from sort of that liberal, scholarly, secular perspective, but with again with a good command of the facts and sort of putting things in their proper context. With that, anything to add on Constantine or any of the stuff we've talked about today?
Again, not off the top of my head, but just giving what have we put into this, an hour and 15 minutes?
Yeah, a little more.
I just want to acknowledge before we go that there is so much more we could say. And to take it back full circle, I think I definitely agree with you about the relative importance of Constantine, for everything that happens since him. I don't think I could possibly dispute that. He's a seminal figure, but a very, very complicated and cagey one, and one that's, still hard to deal with.
Right. Right. Well, with that, The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out other podcasts in our family and get more information about our own show, or see our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please do leave us a review on iTunes to help people find our show, and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can also email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal. On behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
Istanbul, Constantinople, now it's Istanbul. Constantinople, been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul. Now Constantinople, so if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.